Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, I talk to you. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum. Hi.
And I'm Joe McCormick. How are y'all doing today?
Not too bad. I'm sorry. But before we started rolling, a little look behind the scenes here, y'all. Jonathan apologized in advance for his lyric today. And so that was just my reaction to that one.
I feel good about it. And I feel good in general, Joe.
Yes. But Joe, I think that you had something more serious and not 90s pop music related to ask us. Right
no,
there.
I have something very 50s sci-fi related to
Ooh,
talk about.
Even better.
Right. So the other day I was watching a great old classic called The Day the Earth Stood Still.
I thought you were going to say some other thing.
Attack of the Crab Monsters?
No, I thought you
was watching that too.
I thought you were going to say Space Jam.
No.
Okay.
That wasn't
no.
from the 50s.
I know, but he didn't start with a 50s.
Okay.
So. No, The Day the Earth Stood Still. Okay. So aliens arrive. Klaatu comes out of the flying saucer, addresses the ambassador from Earth. I think he gets shot almost immediately.
But, all right, come in peace.
Yeah, but here's how it almost always is in the old movies especially.
Sure.
Aliens are very easy to communicate with because they come down, they arrive at Earth, and they are bipedal primates who speak English with varying degrees of sliminess or
tentacles or
green
weird
coloration.
Things on their heads. Yeah.
Occasionally, they are not able to speak in English. However, they are able to use another human as a conduit through which it can speak English. For example, Independence Day.
Sure.
Yeah. Let us speak not of Dr. Oaken. That's the same guy who played Data, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. Brent Spiner.
It all comes together.
He's also in Night Court.
Well, anyway, in reality, if there are aliens out there, we've got a few problems. They're not coming to Earth, or at least not yet.
Not that we know of,
yeah.
No.
And so that means if we want to talk to them, we need to receive and transmit messages over long distances.
Sure.
And also in the real world, there's no reason to assume aliens already speak perfect American English.
Or what? Have any kind of universal translator.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's first point out that there are a lot of Americans who cannot speak anything close to perfect American English.
Oh, dis.
Like all three of us.
Yes.
Sure. Yeah, sure. I make mistakes all the time.
There are even more basic assumptions than that we probably shouldn't make. So after that, you may be thinking, huh? Well, if we can't assume that aliens can speak, you know, English or Chinese or any other Earth-based language, why on Earth could we ever expect to have a conversation with them? How could we possibly set up communication between different solar systems?
And I do want to impress upon you guys exactly how huge of a problem that is, because we humans have a really hard time understanding each other's languages.
Sure.
Yeah.
A lot.
I mean, modern languages.
Oh, right. And that's not even taking into account ancient languages.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the things I wanted to point out, I had a quick aside in the notes. I love having my asides before we're even able to really dive into the topic, is just the proof that we would have some significant challenges being able to decipher any sort of alien language or be able to communicate meaningfully to aliens. And the way that I feel confident about that is we just look at how we've treated ancient languages that we had lost practically all context around so that mm-hmm. we were unable to understand them for the longest time.
So say, for example, you have a bunch of examples of ancient Egyptian script.
Right.
You've got some hieroglyphics, but there's no translation for them.
Right.
You don't know that this symbol in ancient Egyptian means this symbol or this phonetic unit in another language.
Right.
How
so
on earth can you make sense of it?
The way we made sense of it in the sense of ancient Egyptian hieroglyphs was because we were lucky enough to come across the Rosetta Stone. Now, the Rosetta Stone is a stone that has generally the same passage with minor differences written three times in three different languages. So there's Egyptian hieroglyphs are one of the languages. Ancient Greek is another, and Demotic script, which was a later Egyptian language. Those are the three that are written. And by using those three texts and being able to make comparisons, linguists were able to say, oh, well, this tells us what these different hieroglyphic symbols mean, what they represent, and that was how we began to understand the language of the hieroglyphic images that we would find everywhere that, you know, were artifacts from the ancient Egyptians.
But that all depends on a particular archaeological discovery. If we had never discovered the Rosetta Stone, or I don't know, there may have been other archaeological discoveries since then that could have played the same role. I'm not sure. But if we didn't have those things at our disposal, what would we do?
Basically, we would be completely unable to truly understand this language that beings that were biologically identical to us,
they were humans.
Wrote in, what was that, 3,000 to 5,000 years ago?
Yeah, yeah. So we're talking about our own species and not being able, except through...
On our own planet.
Right. Except through fortuitous circumstance, being able to understand. And on top of that, you get to the pronunciation of ancient Egyptian. We aren't entirely certain exactly what it sounded like. So if someone were to speak ancient Egyptian, like in a film like Stargate, it might not be exactly what it actually sounded like way back when, because, I mean, we still have scholars disagreeing on what the pronunciations were like. So, when we point that out, the reason I point that out is to say, any message that we send that would be purely language-based to an alien life form could be completely indecipherable. I mean, if we're having that much trouble with languages from our own species in our own history, imagine how much more challenging it would be when either an alien race receives something we send or we receive something from an alien race and understanding what that means.
And that sort of brings us to the main thing we want to talk about today. So this month, on Monday and Tuesday, November 10th and 11th of 2014, the SETI Institute held a conference about communication with alien civilizations. And they brought together experts from a vast array of different disciplines to sort of combine their knowledge, put their heads together, and see what their different intuitions based on their different subject areas would come up with reference to insights about and recommendations for communicating with alien civilizations. Mm-hmm. So it was called Communicating Across the Cosmos. And the central question was, how can we make ourselves understood by other civilizations in the galaxy? So the conference had 17 presentations over a couple of days, and we don't have time to talk about all of them here, but we wanted to discuss some of the ideas that were brought up at this conference, and also just talk in general, have a discussion about what it means to try to communicate with aliens, how we could do it, what should we say, how should we say it, and is it something that's possible to achieve?
Yeah, this is something that we've been thinking about for a while. We as a species have been thinking about for a while, not just SETI, but pre-SETI days. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the earlier ideas people have suggested and some of the actual things that we have done that could at least, in theory, be a communication with an alien presence.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting to kind of look at what we've done before. Also, before I forget, I should mention, this reminds me a lot about the episode of How Do You Warn the People of the Future About Something Like a Nuclear Waste Disposal Area?
Right, we
talked about that, and I think in our second episode about dealing with nuclear waste for the future, it was the problem of communicating the fact that a very certain location has been made highly toxic for thousands of years.
Right. How do you create symbols that will last the test of time, knowing that even things that you would first ascribe to being dangerous, like skull and crossbones, today are fashion statements on like clothing and even kids' toys. Mm-hmm. So it's a legitimate issue. Well, same sort of thing, except kind of magnified when you're talking about aliens. That doesn't mean that we haven't tried. So some of the earlier attempts before we get into the actual conference details, there were some folks in the 19th century who thought, well, there might be life on the moon or on Mars. We don't know.
Sure, sure. So especially way back in the very early 1800s. Yeah, they had no idea.
So spell it out on a cornfield, right?
Well, actually, one person did say
oh,
that.
Oh, really?
Yes, one person suggested.
Totally.
One person, just guessing. One person suggested going into something like a cornfield, cutting pathways through it and planting wheat instead so that through the contrast, you could create geometric patterns that could be seen from the moon, therefore being an indication of an intelligence that had put something there, because the thought process went, no natural occurrence would create such perfect shapes.
Okay. All right. That's cool. But what about something further away from than the moon? I mean, right. What if there are aliens on Mars?
Yeah. Martians were, that was a big one, right? Because for a long time, even the patterns that could be seen with the telescopes we had, suggested things like possible canals. You guys have probably heard about canals on Mars.
Yes. Sure.
So this was an idea that was thrown around for a long time. And there are various people who are coming up with ideas of how we might be able to indicate to any sort of civilizations that might be on Mars that we are also here. And there was one guy, Joseph von Littrow, who said, why don't we just create these enormous channels of water and then pour kerosene on top of the water? It'll float on the top of the water. Then we set fire to the kerosene. And so these flaming channels will create the same sort of shapes I was talking about before, but on a massive scale. I'm talking like huge, so that they would be visible from the surface of Mars.
Especially if we're lighting it at night. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So, you know, well, you have to do it at night. I mean, that is a lot.
Otherwise, it's ridiculous.
Right. let's not be silly.
I hope they at least had the foresight to plan it when Mars would be in a position to see Earth. And that side of Earth at night.
I don't think they ever got to a point where any actual work was done. This was purely on the theoretical
That's
side.
That's probably good because that also sounds really quite dangerous.
Yeah. So. Where was all that kerosene going to come from?
Stuff.
Who needs light?
Geoscale kerosene burning. I like it.
Moving into the actual space age when we could do things more meaningful than setting stuff on fire. You know, in this case, we could set things on fire and make it fly up into space. The Pioneer 10 and Pioneer 11 spacecraft each had plaques on them that detailed the origin point for those spacecraft as well as when they were launched. So the plaques measure 6 by 9 inches, which is 15 by 23 centimeters. The plaques were bolted to the frames of the spacecraft, and they show a naked man and a naked woman. The man is waving as if to say, hello, we have no clothes, and we are probably good to eat. The plaque also has a symbolic layout of our solar system as well as our sun's position relative to nearby pulsars so that an alien craft, if it were to encounter one of these, would be able to triangulate the position of our solar system based upon that information. And so that's kind of interesting.
Yeah. But that's essentially just like a giant postcard.
Yeah. Yeah. It was really it was more than just literally, it was symbolic for a couple different reasons.
Oh, sure. No, it was a lovely idea.
And in 1974, we had another one, which was to beam up a message using a radio telescope at the Arecibo Observatory. And it was to the Globular Cluster M13. Lovely neighborhood. Gated community. This is a cluster of stars that's actually pretty dense. So it was thought, well, there are a lot of stars in this cluster. So if, you know, it's just as good as any other potential target for possible intelligent life. And since there are more stars there than there in
it's
theory,
a higher potential.
Yeah, there's probably more planets in that general area. But it's about 25,000 light years away. So that message would take 25,000 years to get there. I mean, that message travels at the speed of light. So the digital message was a 23 pixel by 73 pixel bitmap image. Have you seen the pictures of this?
No, I haven't.
It looks like it's a level from an Atari 2600 game.
Oh, wait. I'm wrong. I have seen it. It looks very interesting.
Yeah.
It looks kind of like Tetris.
Yeah, so what's in the image?
There's a stick figure or a block figure, if you prefer. Some chemical formulas, some numbers. There's also a very simplistic depiction of the radio telescope and the beam that was sent out.
Okay.
But here's the sad trombone moment of this message, which is that the way they aimed the message, they aimed it where the globular cluster M13 was at that moment, not where it will be in 25,000 years.
They didn't lead it.
No.
Yeah.
No, you always got to lead it.
Yeah.
No, they didn't lead it. So
things
by the
Halo have taught me.
Yeah.
Right? And Duck Hunt.
So in 25,000 years, that message will be where M13 was, not where M13 is. So even if there were some sort of intelligent life there, it's not going to be in line with the message by the time it actually gets to where it used to be. So the official response to that particular little stickling fact is that the message was really a technological demonstration rather than a sincere effort to make contact with alien life. And again, if you think, well, it would take 50,000 years for a message to go out and get back to us, assuming that there isn't some sort of trans-hyper communication thing that we don't believe exists.
Uh-huh. And assuming that they're really prompt with answering their mail.
Right. They might be like, just let that sit in the inbox for, you know, a couple millennia. We're talking about 50,000 years before we would hear back. So I'm inclined to believe that, yes, this is really more of a symbolic show of, yes, look at what we're able to do. And fun side fact, since 1999, that radio telescope has gathered data for the SETI at Home project, which we've talked about in distributed computing.
What about those golden records we put on the Voyager spacecraft?
They're pretty cool. Yeah. First of all, they are actually copper disks that are gold plated, so they're not pure gold. So if you were thinking about leaving the solar system so that you could scavenge the gold records aboard the Voyager spacecraft.
Not really worth it, man.
No. People
salvage copper for scrap all the time.
They do.
Yeah, but gold by weight is far more valuable than copper.
Oh, really, Jonathan?
Yes, really. You wanted me to pull up the by ounce? Always go with gold. At any rate.
Actually.
Boys, both of your metal is precious.
This whole conversation is precious. So the message was about our history as a species, leaving out some of the more grim details. The records themselves, they were 12 inches in diameter, which is a little more than 30 centimeters. They had to be played, I think, at 16 2/3 repetitions, revolutions per minute. So not the same as what our typical records here on Earth, you know, the 33s and the 45s. Mm-hmm. This was
But there were instructions for how to play them,
instructions.
Pictured.
Yeah. Yeah, kind of a Pictionary type thing. They also included a needle and a cartridge inside the aluminum plated
envelope
that held the discs, and they had a committee that decided what went on these pair of discs, and it was chaired by Carl Sagan. So there were billions and billions of submissions for that.
That
he went through
not
them all.
True.
No, but I had to say billions and billions because I talked about Carl Sagan. So, it did include music from different cultures and different eras and greetings spoken in 55 languages. And here are some of the music that you could find on those discs.
I'm going to take issue with one of these, but you can go ahead and read them.
You're going to take issue. What? That it was included or that I put it on the list?
That it was included.
Oh, all right. So there's a Bach's Brandenburg Concerto No. 2. Mozart's Queen of the Night aria from The Magic Flute, Stravinsky's Sacrificial Dance from The Rite of Spring, and Chuck Berry's Johnny B. Goode. Is that the one you want to take issue with?
No, it's The Rite of Spring. So we're deciding to set up a channel of communication via physical record with some future alien species. And what we give them is, I'm sure, a very influential and great piece of music, but it's about human sacrifice. It's a ballet about a girl who dances herself to death. And also, it's something that pretty much started a riot the first time it was performed.
Well, it's okay, because none of that context is included with the record, so the aliens will have no way of knowing, unless they have a riot as soon as they hear it, in which case we realize that Stravinsky's effect is truly universal. There's also music from Japan, China, Bulgaria, from Native American tribes, from Aborigines, and more included on those discs.
There's also, this is one of my favorite stories of all time, there's a soundtrack of the heartbeat and brainwaves of Anne Druyen that was taken over the course of an hour in 1977. Anne Druyen was Carl Sagan's wife. Mm-hmm. Until the time of his death, the two of them had fallen in love a couple days before she went in to do this recording. They had been colleagues for years and years and years, or months and months at the very least, and had been working very closely together. And over the course of a telephone conversation, just a couple days before these readings were taken, she and Sagan had this revolutionary, like, I love you, let's get married kind of moment. And so she says that while she was in this EEG machine, she was meditating on falling in love.
Yeah, so there's the sound.
Sounds beautiful.
So that is going out into the universe.
Yeah.
And
there were also images that were converted into analog waves essentially and recorded onto these discs. So, it wasn't just sound. It was also pictures that you could get. Again,
right.
You would have to follow the instructions on the plaque. So these are all examples of previous symbolic attempts, at least, to send messages out to the universe that essentially say, we are here and we are curious about out there. So
this is some of the stuff we do.
That leads into the conference what if we took this the next step instead of it being essentially, you know, we're just hurling a rock out into space that happens to have information about us on it. What if we wanted to take a more you know, a more serious and more concentrated effort mm-hmm. to say we're here.
What can that step be?
Yeah. And so at this conference recently, there were, I'd say we could sort of group different discussions from the conference into sort of different categories. And mm-hmm. one of the first ones I wanted to talk about, because I think it's kind of fundamental to all the other approaches, is what kind of assumptions can we make about the nature of alien minds? Like, what kinds of alien minds should we aspire to talk to, and what kinds of organisms will be able to receive and understand messages that we send in principle?
And it's interesting because there's a lot of discussion on this, right, about all the different types of assumptions that we may or may not be able to make. I'll withhold my own opinion about assumptions until we discuss the other ones, because obviously, okay. you know, I don't want to end up adding my bias to all the conversation that follows.
a few of the people spoke very specifically about this kind of thing, right?
Right. Well, so the idea is, okay, if you assume there is a technologically intelligent species, maybe there are some assumptions we can necessarily make about their psychology.
Like sure.
that you could not be a technological civilization without certain things about your brain being a certain way. Or maybe not physically brain in the way we think of brain, whatever your intelligence organ is.
Yeah, however it manifests.
You know, perhaps like an understanding of mathematics, are you talking about? Or
no, mathematics will be fundamental to when we talk about language, but mm-hmm. I'm talking about even more fundamental psychological conditions. Mm-hmm. So, for example, David Dunair from Lund University gave a presentation that was related to, well, he wanted to say that, yes, we can probably expect to be able to communicate with an alien species, provided that a feature of that alien species is intersubjectivity, which he defines as, quote, the sharing of experiences about objects and events. So it's okay. sort of like the basis of all social behavior.
Uh-huh, and civilization, I would say.
Heck, it's yeah. just the basis of communication, which is yeah. almost a circular argument saying we will almost certainly be able to communicate with an alien species that is capable of communicating.
Well, but without the ability to communicate, we would not be able to communicate with that alien species.
Which so, is I mean, why it's circular.
Well, no. I'm just saying that it's completely a valid point to make, because yeah. there yeah. is absolutely the chance that that a complex alien life doesn't have any methods of communicating with anything outside of itself.
Right. Well, he argues, actually, that any alien species that has the technology to receive our radio messages mm-hmm. will possess intersubjectivity. He says, quote, intersubjectivity is a basic requisite for the emergence of intelligence, sociability, communication, and technology. And I can see the idea there. I mean, you can't imagine... I really think he really might be onto something, that you can't come up with a scenario in which a species that can't communicate ideas or experiences works together to create technology.
Oh, right. Absolutely not.
So at least not one that has any form of individualism.
Right. So he argues that we should sort of expect some attributes that are likely present based on this. We should assume intersubjectivity in alien minds, and we can expect, quote, a sustainable complex social system with a regulated system for collaboration such as ethics, so sort of social complexity, and then complex communication for collaboration and abstract conceptualization. Makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then also a high degree of distributed cognition. And then there is another presentation that I thought was interesting about what we could assume about alien minds. And this was from Tomislav Janovich. And this idea was the role of empathy. Okay, so people like us, we can try to empathize with and subsequently understand the intention of other minds. We can mm-hmm. we have a theory of mind. We can get inside other people's heads.
Yeah, and we do that all the time, even with non-human creatures. Like we assign feelings and thoughts and emotions to dogs and beetles and airplanes.
Right. So yeah, imagine you put yourself in a room, in a locked room with somebody who doesn't speak the same language as you. And you're working on a task together, you may very well be able to work together on a relatively simple task, even without sharing any words in common whatsoever, because there are ways that humans can sort of derive intentionality. I can sort of figure out what you're trying to get me to feel, even without understanding what any of your words mean.
Mm-hmm.
So Yanovich proposes that empathy might be a psychological universal. In other words, it's a feature of almost any intelligent species that could evolve. From that, we get the following guideline. Quote, if our communicants are incapable of understanding the informative intention behind our message, they still might be able to understand our communicative intention, the intention to reveal our presence as intentional beings, for it's much more likely that they will be able to empathetically recognize such an intention than to interpret a signal embodying an explicit representational content.
Right. That at the very least, they would be able to go, hey, this was created by beings who want to say hi.
Yeah, so in both cases here, it's sort of saying that we can assume any technologically intelligent species will have these basic features of psychology, and what can we derive from that that'll help us craft a message, or at least know that there's something worth crafting even if they don't understand it. And I think that's really interesting, but I know, Jonathan, you don't like assumptions. Though I don't think these are just stupid assumptions.
I think
these are very logical and well-informed assumptions.
I don't think they're stupid, and I don't think that they're illogical necessarily. However, I get a little antsy simply because, you know, we have to draw our conclusions, we have to base our assumptions on the most minuscule of sample sizes for a planet that houses intelligent life. Now, there's no way to get around that.
Oh, sure. And Joe, you actually had a point about that, right?
Right. Well, the point you make is something that the people at this conference were highly aware of and talked about in their reflections on it. But I wanted to offer up, for example, one way that I was just trying to imagine, how could it be that these assumptions might be violated? Because I think maybe the two assumptions we just talked about do make a lot of sense. For example, if you try to imagine any species evolving intelligence through natural selection.
Mm-hmm.
But I was wondering, well, maybe we could assume there's a different kind of species out there in the galaxy, and that species could be one that's based on design. Now, I'm not going to that kind of controversial thing here. I'm talking about, imagine a planet populated by intelligent robots created by another alien species, and now the species that created them is extinct.
Or has moved on, or
has gone away to another planet.
Sure.
Or imagine even genuine chemistry-based organic life forms, except instead of bearing minds shaped by the way intelligence naturally grows out of self-replication and natural selection, you've got minds designed to be one way or another by the hyper-intelligent species that engineered them.
Sure.
Or we encounter aliens that have re-engineered themselves to depart from their natural psychology.
So like a singularity on an alien platform.
Right. When you introduce crazy scenarios like this, which who knows, might not be crazy given different assumptions about alien technology, whatever we can assume about psychology based on natural selection and biochemistry that we see here on Earth kind of go out the window. Like, who knows what the purpose of engineered minds might be created for? Anyway, my point is, while I think the points they make are really interesting and good, we can't be 100% sure that the only life we encounter will have arisen by the same forces we did.
Absolutely. I do think that at a certain point, the question is, for our intents and purposes, and not this podcast's intents and purposes, but for humanity's intents and purposes, it's almost moot, because that level of difference in society is going to be, I think that that's going to push it into the impossibility of contact.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Like unless they show up and fail to notice us, but we notice them, like we're never going to talk to them because they don't understand talking.
They would, unless it's, well, if it's a, like you said, some sort of artificial, whether synthetic, robot, chemical, whatever, if it's some sort of artificial intelligence created by aliens that is was designed for a specific purpose by the aliens but is not a reflection upon the actual thought processes, mm-hmm. however you want to define it, of the aliens, but they have access to a radio tower, they could theoretically receive whatever message we send out, but
they wouldn't care.
Yeah. I guess, maybe. I mean, it's kind of hard to say what they would or wouldn't do, right?
Sure. I think that it's pretty solid to go forward. I like that they laid out the fact that what we need to communicate with aliens is essentially empathy and communicability, or communicativeness. That's yes. Communicability is what colds are. Yeah.
Right.
Right. Okay. I don't know. Yeah, okay. Communicabunipku. Anyway. So if we start with the assumption,
yes.
because I think we basically have to
yes.
in order to proceed with the discussion, if we start with the assumption that aliens can understand what intermind communication is and understand intentionality, they can perceive that there are other minds with intentions.
Sure.
What do we do from there, and how can we use language? What kind of tools would we use to get a message in those alien minds?
Yeah, one of the messages that was included, or one of the ideas that was included within this conference, was one that was proposed by Dr. Kim Binstead, that any message sent must be, by necessity, self-contained, because it will take many thousands of years for it to get to wherever that intelligent life might be.
Right. So it can't be like, hey, what's up?
Yeah.
It needs to be the whole message at once.
Right. It can't be a text message, because whoever owns the phone now is not going to be owning the phone by the time the message gets responded to, right?
Yeah.
So it would just be like humans 50,000 years from now, like, who is this that's contacting us, and what do they want? Did one of you guys ask if you left your keys somewhere? What is this about?
Yeah,
it's
not the start of a conversation
no.
in any practical way.
No, it's essentially saying, we are here. This is us. We are here. And like that, very similar to the attempts we talked about in the previous section. But another was that if we want the aliens to understand what we're trying to say, it behoves us to make as few assumptions about that alien's knowledge, cognitive abilities, and even physiology as possible. So, in other words, we can't put all of our eggs into a basket based on lots of different assumptions on the aliens. We should try and make it as open as possible, with as many different avenues as possible, in order to make at least some attempt of understandability to an alien intelligence. And also stated that it was unlikely that an alien intelligence would be able to decode natural language text, no matter how large the sample size. So we've talked about this in artificial intelligence quite a few times, that by feeding enough data into a machine, the machine can eventually learn if it's designed a specific way and the software supports it.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
She argues that might not be the best way to send a message to alien life, that it may not matter that we send, for example, if we were to send, library of books in every language on Earth to an alien species, they might not be able to,
might not be able to do anything with it.
Yeah, the volume
right.
might not help them.
Well, here's the analogy, I think. If you were to give more and more and more ancient Egyptian writing samples
right.
to the pre-Rosetta Stone archaeologists, they still wouldn't have anything to go on.
Yeah, it wouldn't necessarily be helpful. Then you have Dr. Carl DeVito, who held a talk about whether or not mathematics can really be considered a universal language.
And that's a really interesting question, because I think this idea is one of the best things we have going in terms of finding a universal constant to communicate.
Yeah. The presupposition is that anyone who's intelligent enough to look at a message and say, this came from people who want to communicate, is going to have the basis in mathematics that's similar to what we have, that mathematics is the universal.
It's a scene in The Day the Earth Stood Still, actually, where the Klaatu goes into the professor's office and writes a mathematical equation on the chalkboard that helps the professor solve his problem.
Uh-huh.
And the idea is, well, math underlies all of the science of the universe.
Right.
And the idea is, you can't do science or build a radio telescope without understanding things like natural numbers and exponentiation and stuff like that. It's necessary.
And it's interesting, because he actually says, we can't really be entirely sure that math, as we communicate about it here on Earth, is not essentially a human construct that allows us to deal with this. It's a concept we have created so that we can deal with this natural thing. So not that there isn't an underlying universal element here,
but the way that we describe it.
Yeah, the way we deal with it is, in fact, a construct that we humans have made. Now, he argues, or at least he says that he believes, that natural numbers are distinct, that those are universal.
They're Platonic ideals. He believes they are things that exist in the world.
But that the way we deal with those to express mathematical concepts is probably to some extent a human construction and therefore may not make any sense to an alien intelligence in that form. Not that the alien intelligence wouldn't have their own methods of conveying similar concepts, but it may be in a fundamentally different way than we humans do. At which point I said I needed to get an ice cream sandwich and I left my computer. And then I had a nice tasty treat.
Well, yeah, okay. So we think that math might be useful to some extent, but the question is in what's the best way to present math in such a way that it will be understood. Here's another problem with language, especially written language. Our whole concept of communication is influenced by the presence of language. In other words, language isn't just the tool we use to communicate, but it actually changes how our brains work when we're trying to send or receive messages. So in what ways is an Earth language centrism shaping the assumptions we make about alien communication? In what ways is the way we use language blinding us to how best to talk to aliens? This is a question that came up in another presentation. Dr. Sherry Well Jensen, in a presentation called Extraterrestrial Linguistics, discusses the possibility of studying all about 7,000 existing human languages to look for universal features. What do they all have in common, and what do they all lack? What do they all not have in common?
Mm-hmm.
And she points out that while this is still a very limited starting point, because all languages on Earth are still based on Earth conditions and human biology and all that, in the words of the presentation abstract, quote, we can't think outside the box until we've identified the box.
Right.
And mm-hmm. I totally agree with that.
That's kind of where I was coming from with the idea of Earth as our single sample size, is that we don't even have a full idea of what that sample size entails, like big picture wise.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so her idea is we need to do a full sort of look at all of human language and the way human language shapes the assumptions we make about communication. There may be things that we don't even realize we're getting wrong about how to communicate with aliens, because we don't realize the way language is blinding us to some aspects of communication we don't understand.
Sure. Yeah. And obviously our physiology does have a big part to play with that, because a lot of, you know, languages are essentially, especially when you get down to the written part, are a way of translating the sounds we make into meaningful thoughts.
And in spoken language, a lot of our communication actually occurs nonverbally.
Yeah. So this gets really complicated fast.
She said that we need to ask, and I love this quote, She said about the languages, all of the languages of Earth, what presuppositions do they all make? What things are unsaid or even unsayable because these things are too obvious, too obscure, or somehow foreign to human cognition?
Yeah.
These are big, heavy questions. The thing I love about this, by the way, is that even if we get to a point where we say, all right, communicating with aliens is a super far-reaching goal, and we more likely than not will not achieve it. Or if we do achieve it, there's no way of us knowing that we succeeded, because we will all be gone long before it ever happens. Even if you accept all that as true, we're going to learn so much about ourselves as a species mm-hmm. just through the process of self-reflection that there is genuine use out of this. So even for people like me who get a little grouchy toward the end, say, what's the use? I can't even communicate with the kids that come around with their BOGO sticks and their scooters all over in my front yard.
What just happened in here?
I get a little
what
grouchy.
What are you doing? Okay.
I'm just saying.
There's always learning to be had,
there's
even
value.
From those kids with their newfangled internet surfboards.
They're not going to teach me nothing I don't already
okay,
know.
Okay, okay, okay. Enough talk. Let's get down to the real deal.
Okay.
We've talked about theory. We've talked about what can we expect about alien minds? What can we expect about the nature of communication? What could possibly be understood? Let's just get to some real proposals. What should we send?
So
we're going to send data. It's going to be data of some kind.
What do we want to tell them about us? What do we not want to tell them about us?
In some cases, it's not just data. Some people have suggested actually sending stuff out. If you're already talking about it taking forever and a day for the message to get there, then what's a few thousand more millennia between friends? So one idea is to send earthly artifacts or images of those artifacts. Of course, that assumes that the alien life will be able to perceive such things, mm-hmm. which, you know, granted, again, if we get too far out from the human concept of perception, then communication is meaningless anyway. So it does end up becoming a moot point. So eventually we can say, like, all right, fine, those people won't, or aliens won't pay attention to it, but maybe the next set will. Carrie Patterson, who is an artist, had an interesting idea. She suggested we send smells as part of our message.
Ooh.
So sort
I
of
love
like
that.
I know.
That's brilliant.
Chemical signatures that kind of give an idea of what life on Earth is like. And she included, you know, everything among that, like including things like, you know, an orange blossom or the smell of car exhaust, you know,
And maybe they don't have noses per se, but if they can, if they can interpret chemicals in a way at all similar to the way that we do, I mean, we can scientifically define what the smell of orange blossom is. So.
I'm sorry. I have to say her presentation was called Making Sense of Life on Earth.
Oh, that's worthy of us. Good job. Good job, Carrie Patterson.
Exactly what I would have titled that. As long as whatever alien species doesn't immediately get poisoned by said chemical signatures, I think that would be a pretty good message.
Yeah. Our best.
Yeah, we weren't really trying to do that. Now, personally, I think that worrying about what to send is almost as moot as the consideration of whether or not the aliens are going to be able to understand us. Because if the aliens can understand us, then it almost doesn't matter what we send anyway, because whatever people will be around by the time the aliens receive the message will be so different from what we are today that we can't even anticipate what's going to be alien to humans of the future, much less to a species living off on another planet.
So you're getting into the kind of moral decision of whether to send, for example, the car exhaust as a sample or only the beautiful orange blossom.
Right.
If we're sending them an encyclopedia, if we're going to cut out all the parts about war and terrible stuff.
Right. I mean, there are some people who say, you know, the messages they want are all very positive, messages of peace and greeting and friendship, that kind of thing. And there are others who say, well, maybe we should send a more complete picture of what we humans are, with all complete with our frailties, our failings, the dark side as well as the light. There's debate back and forth, and I ultimately think it doesn't really matter.
Oh, I think it's such an interesting question, though. I mean, it's such a huge difference between saying, like, hey, y'all, we exist, and saying, hey, y'all, here's the sum of all of our knowledge, here's our weaknesses, and here's the really terrible stuff that we've done to each other a whole bunch over the course of history.
Yeah.
It depends on what kind of information you decide to send. If you're trying to send something about the history of humanity, it's not necessarily at the zoomed out view a very pretty picture.
Well, in a lot of senses, it's not. But I mean, there are a lot of things that you could include about just general progress that are pretty amazing. The strength of the human intellect is a really incredible story. But the ultimate thing I keep coming back to is that you're talking about tens of thousands of years into the future before the message is even received.
Right.
The people, if there are people, so if there are humans at that time, are going to be fundamentally different from the way you and I are right now. We're talking about more time than has been in the recorded history of humans. And with things changing as quickly as they do, I don't think that it will be pertinent to whatever people are alive at that point, much less any point when an alien species decides to respond back.
Right. This is touched on by Albert A. Harrison of UC Davis in the presentation he gives, which is about the fact that when you're sending a message to an alien species, you're sending a time capsule.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, when it reaches them, it's not going to be about Earth's present. It's about Earth's past.
It's almost a point of vanity, I would say, of whether or not we're including the bad stuff along with the good, because it's It's the equivalent of intergalactically speaking, creating an OkCupid profile and just deciding what you want to put on it.
This one picture makes me look awesome.
I'd say for that reason, I'm definitely on the side of let's be real. I mean, you don't want to start a conversation spanning perhaps hundreds of thousands of years on a note of deception.
It might be a moot thing by the time the message gets there.
Oh, sure, but, sure. Yeah. I mean that too. I mean, you know, the humans who would possibly receive a message back at least 50,000 years in the future, whatever it happens to be, would probably think that we're just as gross as those aliens.
Yeah, they might not even know what the aliens are referring to because we have no way of knowing if their history is going to be at all accurate.
Totally.
But here's the question. What do we send? I mean, we're talking about sort of the tonal approach of the thing we should send. Yeah. What is the actual thing? Do you send them the Encyclopedia Britannica? What is the thing?
I really liked Dr. Seth Shostak. I'm going to go with that pronunciation. Yes. Who is the senior astronomer and director of the Center for SETI Research, suggested that we send everything, the whole internet. Actually, or a very large part of it at the very least. He argues that since it's that the internet is so wide ranging and also redundant at the same time, that it would be the most likely thing to help aliens understand us.
I do think that it's a tragedy that 50,000 years into the future, humans and aliens are going to go to war because 4chan.
I would declare war on us for 4chan.
I would too.
Probably. I'm sorry, 4chan. I don't really mean that. I love you. No. I mean, I think it's a beautiful idea, honestly, because it's such a sum and a breadth of humanity.
I agree with it. I mean, you know, practicality aside, the idea of whether or not this is actually ever going to have any practical outcome. And it may not. I think it's a worthy endeavor, and I also think that if you're going to do it, you go whole hog. I agree with both of you that all this information needs to be conveyed because that is who we are. And if the purpose of this is to say we are here, this is who we are, and this is what we're all about, then you've got to include everything. You can't just do the pretty roses and everything. What happens
you don't want to get to the first date and have them say you're not what you looked like in your picture.
What if they were to show up? Let's say this, I'm going to take this semi positively. Let's say that the aliens show up many hundreds of thousands of years from now. And by then we as a species have left Earth and what is left behind is a shell of what was there. They're going to wonder, how did this happen? Based upon this picture we received where everything was really awesome. Did some other alien species get here before us and wipe them out? No, we pretty much did that to ourselves. We just left that out of the profile.
In which case, they would create a new species of intelligent robots to populate our shell of a planet, turn it back into a nice place, and then create a new human race that was never aware of the one that came before. And there's the premise for your new movie.
And they leave behind one Rosetta Stone. And then they...
Okay, well, I wanted to finish on one last note, which is that after the conference, Dr. Seth Shostak wrote a piece in the Huffington Post that had some sort of post-conference reflections that I thought were interesting. And the main one, he said, it was sort of emerged as a leitmotif of the conference, which was avoid anthropocentrism. It's tough to do because it's the only thing we have. Yeah. Humanity is the only intelligence we know about. Uh-huh. And it's the hardest thing, but we also recognize it's the most important thing. You've got to remember to think these are not humans. These are not humans. But how do you do that?
Yeah. No, I mean, how do you do that and still do any meaningful action?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's by its very nature a very difficult thing. And, you know, but it's cool to have these thought experiments because, like I said, if nothing else, we start to push forward everything from our own understanding of us as a species to technology as well.
Obviously, what we should send is the movie Space Jam.
You want to declare hostilities towards an alien race?
I think the best way to give the aliens a sense of what humanity is like would be to send them Space Jam and Cop and a Half.
I've seen Star Trek The Next Generation, and I'm perfectly aware that sending aliens our media is not the best way to introduce us to them, because it will all end in some bizarre holodeck experiment where they think that pulp novels were real.
But they didn't send Space Jam. See, they sent the wrong thing.
Whereas I've seen Galaxy Quest, and I know that by sending aliens our pop culture, we can
they
go on a wacky
adventure.
They
will be terrified to invade us because of our basketball prowess.
I think we need to send them Theodore Rex starring Whoopi Goldberg. That's my own personal opinion.
I think that this is precisely why neither of you are in charge of this kind of thing.
Very likely so. So this has been largely a philosophical discussion, and in some cases a debate, which is awesome. That's one of the reasons why I like that we have multiple hosts for this show, so that we can actually have a discussion and not just a, this is the part where I recite the things that we have researched. It's good, and I really have enjoyed it. It was also a real mind bender of a topic, because it forces you to sit there and say, well, how do I think about not being human? But it's the sort of thing we love to tackle. So guys, if you out there have suggestions for other topics that are also real mind benders, you should let us know. Send us a message. Our email address is fwthinking@howstuffworks.com. Or drop us a line on Twitter, Google Plus, or Facebook. Twitter and Google Plus, we are FW Thinking. Just search FW Thinking and Facebook will pop right up. Leave your message. Let us know what you think. Maybe you want to weigh in on this alien communication topic. We'd love to hear your thoughts on it. Tell us, and we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.